Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled The Controversy Over Affirmative Action. Recorded in 1997, Dennis McQuestion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, Dalton Cross, professor of law at the University of Texas at Austin Leno Graglia, and former University of California regent, businessman, and activist Ward Connolly discuss the state of race-based preferences in education and employment. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Affirmative action, two words which seem to stir emotions on all sides of this issue. Today's program is not a debate on its pros and cons. We've done that on two other occasions. Rather, it's a dialogue among two controversial individuals who are both critics of affirmative action, and of course me. Though we'll undoubtedly discuss the pros and cons of affirmative action, our goal is to give you three things. First, an opportunity to meet up close and personal two individuals who are at the forefront of advocating change in affirmative action. Second, to provide what I hope is a clear view of the history of affirmative action. And finally, we want you to understand where this public policy issue stands today and how precarious is the state of race relations in America as the 20th century comes to a close. Now, we do not have a studio audience today, as our regular studio is in use, and this one's too small to accommodate one. So let's meet our panel. I'd like to begin on my right with Leno Graglia. He's the A. Dalton Cross Professor of Law at the University of Texas in Austin. A Brooklyn, New York native, he was educated at Columbia, formerly served with the Justice Department, is a recognized expert on school busing, and a staunch opponent of affirmative action. Leno, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dennis. Glad to be here.
Sitting next to him is Ward Connolly. He led California's campaign to bring race and gender-based preferences to an end, first at the University of California and then as chairman of the California Civil Rights Initiative. Proposition 209, as it was called, passed in November of 1996 by a 54-46% margin. Ward, welcome to Texas.
Thanks, Dennis. Thanks for having me.
You, obviously, both of you have put yourself in a position to come under a lot of criticism because of this very important issue. And Ward, I'd like you to begin by giving that viewer some sort of perspective on where we are in affirmative action here as the 20th century comes to a close.
Dennis, I think that we're ending an era of unbridled liberal activism and trying to do what we think is noble but really is very harmful to society as a whole. For about 20, 25 years, we have been trying to make up for the past. And we're making up by doing things that just violate the very essence of what democracy is. We are, in the name of building diversity, giving people preferences on the basis of skin color. And for a long time, we didn't challenge that. We let academicians and government agencies go about their business with no challenge from the people themselves. The political structure wouldn't challenge them because of the identity politics that have been in place. Legislatures won't challenge them because many of the legislatures are controlled by identity politics. And so there comes a time in our nation when the people sort of grab the pitchforks and charge the hill in a figurative sense. In California, we did that through the initiative process. We've done that with tax reform. We've done it with campaign finance reform. We did it with illegal immigration. And we resorted to that process to win preferences.
You got in this process, this almost a morass, I'm sure you think of it sometimes, because of all the flack that you've taken personally and all. But tell us who Ward Connolly is, how you got involved in the University of California system, what happened there, and then lead us all up through what Proposition 209 was all about.
Well, I'm a 58-year-old person who was born in the South, lived in the South for about 5 or 6 years, and then moved out west. During my years of growing up, I've experienced some discrimination. I know what prejudice is, and as George Bush would say, been there, done that, wouldn't be prudent to do it again. And I know the sting of discrimination. I know the sting of prejudice. And when I was in college, I chaired a student committee against discrimination in housing. And down to the core of my being, I believe that classifying people, first of all, is fundamentally wrong. I don't like that. I want to do away with the silly little boxes. And beyond classifying people on the basis of skin color, to confer benefits on that basis, to have different standards for who gets into college and who gets to go to law school and who gets a contract or who gets a job on the basis of skin color or how they spell their last name is morally wrong. I've always believed that. I haven't made a detour from that system of belief at all.
So it's not something that you just came to recently. It's something that's been part of you, but recently you either were in a position to or in some way found yourself embroiled in this controversy. And that goes back to when?
Well, I was, as I often say, I was sentenced to a 12-year unpaid term on the Board of Regents of the University of California in 1993. And until that point, I didn't really know, as most Americans don't, that affirmative action was not just another word for equal opportunity, that it had become a system of preferences and quotas and set-aside contracts in which we were giving people 5% preferences on the basis of skin color. You could bid $105,000 for a job and get it over a white male who was bidding $100,000 for a job. And I didn't know we were doing those things. And then when I was appointed to the Board of Regents in California, I came up close and personal with what was going on. And it really just violated everything that I believed in and what I thought this country stood for.
And so you decided to get active and do something about it. And I'm going to come back to what you did and how you did it. Leno, give that viewer some historical perspective on this. I mentioned at the top of the program that you're a recognized authority in school busing. So you may want to take us all the way back to Brown versus Board of Education, then bring us up fairly quickly past the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as an example. What did those things do? What were we trying to do that now seems to be not working?
To make a slight emendation on what Ward said, he said about this going back 20 to 25 years to try to make up for the past. Actually, it goes back rather longer than that. This really begins in the late 60s. We've had racial preference programs at the University of Texas Law School since at least 1968 now. So it's been 30 years. And it has nothing to do with making up for the past. That is, this is not at all, racial preferences are not at all a program for helping people who need help. The people who need help are the people in the inner cities from the so-called underclass. And those people's problem is not are they getting into med school or law school. Their problem is are they getting out of grammar school alive. So if you wanted to help people who need help, this would be one of the least appropriate ways to do so. It's only the middle class and the upper middle class that are benefited. And I think it's very important to recognize that it has nothing to do with compensating for disadvantage. The people who are helped by racial preferences in admission to law school, for example, are among the most advantaged of people. No one has ever been denied, no black or Mexican-American has ever been denied preference at the University of Texas Law School on the grounds that he or she was not advantaged. They could be from wealthy families, cultured parents. To get more specifically to your question, the civil rights revolution is thought to begin with the famous Brown v. Board of Education case in 1954 prohibiting school segregation. Very quickly, that became entirely effective and enforceable, which it hadn't been for 10 years, but it became effective with the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The 1964 Civil Rights Act was meant to prohibit race discrimination in all public affairs and circumstances. For example, any institution that receives federal funds, like that's almost every college, public and private, may not discriminate on the basis of race. And the story of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, or of the history of race discrimination since then, is a story, a really incredible story, of standing every one of those provisions on its head, making it mean the opposite. For example, Title IV of the Act says desegregation of public schools means assignment without regard to race. It does not mean assignment for racial balance. It repeats it. The courts come along and say that under that section, it is permissible to assign on the basis of race for racial balance. The exact opposite.
And you got yourself in some hot water, I guess, back in the 60s, arguing against
this.
Well,
I have been discussing this and that busing for racial balance, apart from everything else, is directly contrary to the terms of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And we could go down the other sections with the same result. Title VI is the section that says any institution receives federal funds cannot discriminate. And yet here we have institutions like the University of Texas that receive federal funds openly, plainly, racially discriminating. That is, blacks or Mexican Americans are being admitted by with different standards. Again, it's very important to understand. Ward is perfectly right, of course, when he says advantaging some people and therefore disadvantaging others on the basis of race is just immoral. Most people think government should not injure, disadvantage any person on the grounds of race. But I would add, in addition to that, it's also very impractical. It's not going to work in most circumstances. For example, in higher education, when we're talking about preferences, so-called affirmative action, we're not talking about tipping the balance or breaking ties, which people sometimes think of. We're talking about overcoming very large gaps. At the University of Texas Law School, for example, they had that the automatic reject score for white applicants, reject, was higher than the automatic admit score for blacks. If you have a certain score and you check white, you're an automatic reject. You check black, you're an automatic admit. And the admit score for blacks was actually lower, automatic admit, than the reject score for whites.
Was for whites. Now, you found not exactly that, but a similar situation in California, Ward. But before I let you get to that, one of the things that I think it's important that that viewer know is that sometimes you and perhaps both of you are seen as absolutely, you want to totally do away with anything that resembles affirmative action. So I first of all ask you, Ward, is that your objective, is getting rid of, quote, affirmative action? If so, yes, and if no, what?
No. The answer to that is no, we're not trying to get rid of affirmative action. And although our opponents in the 209 campaign, media and otherwise, tried to suggest that this was a campaign to end affirmative action, we made it very clear that there are some forms of affirmative action that we wanted to continue.
Such as what?
Outreach, for example, simply going into neighborhoods and letting people know that job opportunities are available or that there are opportunities to bid on contracts. That is affirmative action in its purest. We don't want to end that. We wanted to end preferences.
And what is the difference? I mean, we hear the words preferences, I hear the word quotas, and people would say that there's nothing in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that talks about quotas. In fact, what was it that Hubert Humphrey, who was sort of the author of that, or at least one who pushed it, what did he say about the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that he would do if quotas ever resulted?
He would eat the paper that it was written on. And people often say he'd have a great case of indigestion now because he would certainly be eating some pretty rotten paper.
Exactly.
But the thing that we're trying to end, and it's so clear and so direct in Proposition 209, 37 words that say, the state shall not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to any individual or group. And nowhere in there do you find the words affirmative action.
Well, I want to look at two graphics now. Let's look at the graphic that you just talked about, which is graphic two. And those are the words that you obviously know by heart at this point. And there they are again, and I'll just read it from here. The state shall not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to any individual or group on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in the operation of public employment, public education, or public contracting. Before we look at the other one, Ward, let me ask you, why did you in Proposition 209 draft it using exactly that language? And you have the public things at the end. Why the reference to public education, public contracting, et cetera?
Those are the things that government agencies do. And what you do in your own private business is up to you. If you want to be conscious about race or ethnic background or whatever we call whatever race is, and I'm not sure any longer what that means, but ethnic background, if you want to do that in your private life, that's your business. But those of us who pay taxes, we want our government not to use those factors in conferring benefits upon us. And it's very clear that's culturally driven, it's morally right, it's our Constitution. It's what the 1964 Civil Rights Act said. And we're just simply trying to get back to what John F. Kennedy said in June of 1963, and that is, race has no place in American life or law.
All right, let's look at graphic number one. And that first graphic talks about some of the language from the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So if we could see that. And the language is pretty similar. It says, no person in the United States shall, on the grounds of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity. Is there Ward, a reason why the language is somewhat similar from Prop 209 to the Civil Rights Act, was that intentional?
It was intentional. I think the Civil Rights Act said, of 64, said treat everybody the same, treat them equally. Don't have different standards for people on the basis of whether they're a member of an historically underrepresented group. Don't treat white males differently than you treat other people. And over the years, it has become fashionable for us to make those distinctions.
You would agree, though, as I assume the opponents of yours have said many times, that there has been a history of discrimination against certain groups, particularly African-Americans, women, others in this country. Would you not agree with that?
I would agree with that. Okay. However, that does not allow our government, it does not entitle our government to discriminate against anybody else on the basis of their skin color, their ethnic background, whatever. Two wrongs, as they say, do not make a right. Trying to cure discrimination in the past does not justify your discriminating against somebody else right now. And this isn't about groups. You'll find in both of those charts there, both of those graphics, you will find reference to persons. You will find reference to individuals, not giving any preference to anybody on the basis of their group.
All right. Now, Lino, let me ask you to bring us up to speed from the Civil Rights Act. What happened in 1964 up to today, the idea of group rights, so to speak, as an example? And what were a couple of the key cases that were passed on, some by the Supreme Court, I guess, and others, that sort of defined this sort of change from what apparently was meant to where we are today?
Everybody understood that Brown v. Board of Education in 1954 said that the Constitution, the United States Constitution, prohibits government, public officials, state and federal, from discriminating against any person on the basis of race. All right, the 1964 Act was an adoption and an endorsement of that principle. Finally, Congress came aboard and the country agreed racial discrimination, the era of race discrimination, segregation, and all forms of race discrimination is over and has to end. And so the Act, in several sections called titles, disallows racial discrimination in public accommodations, in employment, in education.
Do you agree with those titles? Were you in agreement with the Act or a big part of it at that time?
Well,
are you today?
Definitely, indeed. The Act was meant to prevent racial discrimination. At that time, my wife and I were contributing to the NAACP and to Martin Luther King to fight discrimination, which was over. Everybody agreed discrimination was unjustifiable. As I said, the history since that time has been a history of standing the Act on its head. All these provisions meant to prohibit discrimination became either permissions for or requirements of discrimination. An almost incredible performance by the courts, and most importantly, the Supreme Court. People just don't believe how courts can do what they do. But you had Title IV that said that desegregation means a sign without regard to race, not busing for racial balance. The court says we require busing for racial balance. You've got the employment section, Title VII, that says you should not take race into account. The court, in one of the most important cases of all time, Griggs v. Duke Power, said that no employer may use any standard employment requirement, like, for example, literacy or a high school education, if it excludes more blacks than whites. So now, instead of being able to set your employment qualifications without regard to race, they held, in essence, you may not set them except with regard to race. The one of the most important cases in 1971 was Swan v. Charlotte Mecklenburg, was the first case in which the court ordered busing for racial balance. Another important case, the Weber case, the court held that when the Act says no racial discrimination, Congress didn't mean whites. Brennan said for the Supreme Court, it's true that Mr. Weber, a white man, a laborer seeking to improve his position within the company, it was held that no, he was not entitled to take a course that would improve his position because there was a quota for blacks. And so blacks had to get the slots and not him.
And the Supreme Court came down against him.
The Supreme Court came down against him. The court said, well, it's true. It looks like he has a pretty strong case because the Act says you can't discriminate in employment or promotion on the grounds of race, which is exactly what they were doing to him. And Justice Brennan said, well, it looks like he has a strong case if you take it literally, but you got to consider the spirit of the Act. And the spirit of the Act, I mean, this is lawyers. Lawyers can turn anything around, and Supreme Court justices can turn things around better than anybody else. The spirit of the Act, it turned out, meant exactly the opposite of what the Act said. The other, perhaps, most important case is the famous Bakke case. Bakke versus Regent University of California, where again, you had this provision that an institution taking federal funds can't discriminate. The University of California takes federal funds. It was the medical school at Davis, and so it was covered by this. Besides, it was also covered by the Constitution, because it's a state institution. So they can't discriminate under this statute, but they did. They set up a quota. They set aside a certain number of seats for blacks, Mexican-Americans, and a few others.
And Bakke was one who didn't make it because of the quota that gave other people with lower test scores.
Yes. Bakke had test scores on the MCAT, the Medical College Admission Test. He had test scores averaging in the 95th percentile in these different sections. They rejected him, and he had a very high GPA, grade point average in college. They rejected him in favor of blacks and Mexican-Americans who had scores in the 30th percentile. I mean, we're talking enormous gaps. Goes to the Supreme Court. Four justices were willing to say, look, you can't do this. It's prohibited by the 1964 Act. We can read. But four other justices says, no, led by Justice Brennan, the Act means whatever we say it means. They didn't mean to prevent discrimination against whites, only discrimination against blacks. And so you can do whatever you want. The ninth justice, Justice Powell, tried to take a midway position, neither here nor there. And his position was, four who say you can't discriminate are right. You can't discriminate except just a little bit.
Was that the majority opinion?
Well, that became the opinion of the court. Four said you can't, four said you can, and the ninth one said you can't, but you can. You know, he took this impossible, childish, have it both ways position, and that's where we are in higher education. This is the leading case, the Bakke case, that, you can't really have quotas or set aside separate seats, but you can use race as a plus factor to break a tie or tip the balance, as he puts it. Well, that's not how race is used.
To achieve diversity.
Yeah, right. And the justification that Justice Powell came up with is you'll get educational diversity. Now, of course, what do you mean diversity? You'll get diversity in nothing but different races. You'll get diverse points of view. And I think that's a good point to mention. You know, what is affirmative action? That you mentioned, the proponents say they want affirmative action. Opponents like to talk about racial preferences. Let me say that affirmative action, as Ward said, making sure that everybody knows about opportunities is not controversial. Affirmative action, so-called, is controversial, is worth discussing, only insofar as we mean racial preferences. Only insofar as people get an advantage because of race and other people get a disadvantage. And secondly, as I said, these gaps, these advantages and disadvantages, in higher education at least, are not matters of breaking ties or tipping balances. They're very large.
And large, as you talked about earlier. Now, this kind of brings us up to where, Ward, as you say, you got this 12-year non-paid senator as a member of the Board of Regents in the University of California system. Now, I assume that you, like probably most people watching this program, had sort of followed along some of these things. I remember the Bakke case when it came along. I didn't know as much about it then. And I assume that as a business, you're a businessman, not a lawyer, which is something obviously in your favor in most places. Excuse me, Leno, if I may say that. But so when you became a board member, you found, what kind of things did you find? And then what did the University of California do about it at that time?
I found that at the University of California at San Diego campus, we were giving all members of historically underrepresented groups, and there were three in that category, we were giving them 300 bonus points. No means test, no residency test, no citizenship test, automatic 300 bonus points. And so one could be the son of a Massachusetts doctor or the son of a general in the Army and come to California, get 300 bonus points, and yet the son or a daughter of a Vietnamese dishwasher wouldn't get those bonus points. You give one 300, you're taking it away from another. Mm-hmm. And not only was there no means test, but we were turning away students who happened to be Asian or white with 4.0 grade point averages, 1,400 on the SAT, in favor of historically underrepresented students with 2.8, 980 on the SAT. One needs to understand that at four of our campuses in California, every year, there are from 25,000 to 31,000 students applying for those four for each of those four campuses.
And how many slots are we talking about?
There are about 3,500 slots at each one of them.
So you have like eight times as many applicants for each slot.
And out of that 25,000 students, 9,000 or more will have 4.0. They've been playing by the academic rules for admission to an academic institution.
Okay, but there are those who will say that using just this standard testing, first of all, discriminates against some groups, and secondly, that it's not the only measure that one ought to use to get somebody into college. How would you respond?
Well, the problem is, however, that they only apply that reasoning after the contest is over. They want to apply the academic standards to the Asian and whites. And then after that is over, well, now let's look at them holistically, the rest of them. And that's different standards. If they wanted to apply holistic standards, as we apply, by the way, we allow them to do. We allow the supplemental criteria now, absent the consideration of race. If you want to do that, that's fine. But apply the same standards to everybody without consideration of race and color and ethnicity and national origin.
If I may interject there, add to this again. What we're talking about at Berkeley, University of California at Berkeley, the flagship of the California system, the median SAT score may be 1,250 points out of a total of 1,600, 800 on the verbal, 800 on the math. 1,600 is high. 1,250 is a very high score. The 300-point bonus that Ward is talking about meant that the median SAT score for blacks was 950. Now, apart from everything else, when you put two groups of people in the same institution trying to compete with one another, with that kind of a gap, 300 points accounts for like 4 years of academic preparation. That just can't work. And it is a result of this, of racial preferences, is the reason why we have demands for black studies, multiculturalism, sensitivity training, speech codes.
Separate dorms
and graduation ceremonies. All this follows, and it can't possibly work. Now, your question about are the tests biased? Maybe we shouldn't be using the same admission standard, the SAT test. And the answer is they are not. A biased test, by usual definition, would be one which does not accurately reflect ability. If the SAT test did not reflect the ability of the preferred groups, then it shouldn't be used. That is, if, for example, blacks did better in school than their SAT score indicated, then it would be a biased test.
Okay, but they're
And it is proven, it is important to understand that it's proven time and time again that that is not the case. Blacks and Mexican Americans do not outperform these scores. These tests are every bit as accurate for them as they are for whites.
But there's all kinds of examples. I think you admit that there are people who come in with lower scores and who do, in fact, turn out to be in let's just say, the top half of the class or the top two-thirds of the class.
No standard is perfect, but there's nothing peculiar about blacks and Mexican-Americans in that regard. There are plenty of whites who don't do well on the test and yet could succeed in the school. So that's certainly no basis for racial preferences. This preference is given only to blacks and Mexican-Americans because they simply want people of those colors in the school.
Yeah, let me also say this about that, Dennis. We recently had a Latino eligibility task force come to the University of California, to the board, and argue that the SAT should be abolished because it discriminated against Latinos. The argument, however, was that Latinos could not afford to take the crash courses that allowed them to perform better on the exams. That's not a matter of an ethnic discrimination. That's income. If we wanted to give scholarships for them to take the crash course to get prepared for it, fine. But the bias is not in the exam. The bias, if there is one, was an income bias.
All right. Now, but being in California, article in today's paper, in Berkeley, if I'm not mistaken, one African-American student admitted to law school this year versus 20, 30, 40 in years past.
Yes.
How would you respond?
It shows that we've been giving some preferences that were of a pretty high magnitude. Otherwise, we're discriminating now. All of a sudden, this institution that has been giving preference for all these years has now become racist. And I don't think anybody believes that. That doesn't pass the giggle test. So what we're doing here is we've been giving preferences. And one of the best pieces of work on that is Dr. Martin Tro at Berkeley, who says that the degree of the preference really is a function of the magnitude of the drop that's occurring.
Let me give you a quote from, this is from Franklin Jennifer, who has been on our program before. He's the president now of the University of Texas at Dallas. And he said that if you take away these preferences, that it's going to be hell, that you better make sure you prepare for it, indicating that there could be some backlash. Now, Lino, we've talked about most of the key cases, but there's one that happened at the University of Texas just 2 or 3 years ago, the Hopwood decision. Tell us specifically what that is and how it relates to this discussion.
The Hopwood decision is a decision by the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, as we say. And that case holds that the schools of the Fifth Circuit, that's Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, may no longer engage in any form of racial discrimination. It's a simple and complete bar of racial discrimination. It doesn't say anything about affirmative action other than racial discrimination. There's no racial discrimination. And that means that the racial preferences that before were being used at the University of Texas, for example, can't be used anymore. And the result of that at the law school where I am is that, as you said, instead of having maybe 30 blacks in the law school, today there are 4. Instead of having maybe 40 Mexican-Americans in the law school, today there are 25. Without racial preferences, we granted admission to about 11 blacks by the same standards as everyone else. They met those standards. Although don't let nobody say that, well, blacks and Mexican-Americans can't meet the standards. Many of them can, happily, not in the same proportions for whatever reason now. So we granted admission to 11 blacks and to about 40 Mexican-Americans. And we have admitted and actually enrolled 4 of those blacks to whom we granted admission enrolled. The others found better deals, even better deals elsewhere, and about 25 Mexican-Americans enrolled. So we have a representation, we have people, but with the enormous advantage that these people who are enrolled there now know that they were enrolled like everybody else. And everybody else knows that. They don't have to operate under the stigma of being an affirmative action baby, as the black law professor at Yale called it, with everybody knowing they don't meet the standards. They meet the standards. Their chances of doing well in that school should be equal to everybody else, instead of, in effect, being condemned to the bottom half or the bottom quarter of the class. That's an enormous advantage.
Ward, this idea of this stigma. Now, I've heard it discussed many times on all sides of the issue. I've heard many people say, leaders particularly in the black or African-American community, that, look, we need this these preferences. We do it because of slavery and because of, as you say, historically disadvantaged or whatever. Once you give them this, surely there's some feedback, some fallout, once you try to take it away in California, as you did in the school system. Tell us what you did in the school system, and then bring us up to exactly why Proposition 209 was on the ballot in November of 96.
Well, you know, let's be honest here. When people talk about, well, there's going to be some fallout, there's going to be a backlash, they're going to resist it. I haven't seen an industry of any sort that when you want to take away something that that supports having it taken away. If you want to take away farm subsidies, guess what? The farmers are going to oppose this. If you want to eliminate the deduction on the mortgage interest, you believe that the real estate industry is going to applaud that?
And the bankers too.
And the bankers as well. So when you start talking about taking away preferences based on race, those who thrive on this, who live this game, Jesse Jackson and others, they're going to fight it. Whether it's morally right or not, there's a vested interest in maintaining that system.
Yeah, but when you're talking about things that are economic, like mortgage deduction as an example, or the farm subsidies as an example, while people certainly can get passionate about that, it seems as if we almost have created on the race situation something that is almost, and we've done programs on so many controversial topics, but abortion would certainly be very close to the top of that. And it's almost in this country today as if it's something that either people can't talk about, don't want to talk about, feel uncomfortable talking about, feel guilty about. I'm not sure if that captures a sense of where race is
in
America
today. If I can interject, one of the worst things about a regime of racial preferences is that it makes us talk about race. One of the great beauties of a system of law that was race neutral, didn't care about anyone's race, made all questions of racial difference irrelevant. If someone said blacks and whites differ as groups in some regards, the answer would be, well, maybe that's of interest to sociologists or somebody, but it's not to law. Law deals only with individuals. And once you say, well, it's sensitive, and if you oppose racial preferences, you're raising a sensitive subject. No, it's racial preferences that raise the sensitive subject, not the opposition to them.
Well, Lino, you have certainly not been without controversy in your life, but in the last 60 days or so, you have been raised, you've been on every national program that I can possibly imagine. The name Lino Graglia has been almost as famous as Ward Connerly on this issue. Because a few weeks ago, you were asked to make a speech. Tell us what the occasion was, who the group was, what you said, and what kind of trouble you got in as a result of it.
A student group was organized at the University of Texas to support the Hopwood decision. That is, to argue that the elimination of all racial preferences was a good thing. University officials were doing, and legislators were bemoaning the decision constantly. The law school dean almost every day would issue a statement, Hopwood is a tragedy. Hopwood is terrible. Well, these students wanted to say that Hopwood is not a tragedy. Elimination of racial preferences, indeed, is one of the healthiest things that could happen to this country if we're to maintain a multiracial society. So, and I would like to also interject the question about but blacks and Mexican Americans say we need these preferences, there's no stigma. You know, I've received literally hundreds of letters that I have in my office from prominent blacks and Mexican Americans saying, we don't want preferences. We don't want the stigma. I believe that I and my people can compete with everyone else.
Now, the studies that I've seen show about 2 out of 3 African Americans or blacks believe exactly what you say. But he was talking about, and Ward, you were talking about this issue of, I don't know if you mentioned the word industry, but it's sort of people who sort of thrive and make their living on, exactly. Is that what you implied?
Yeah, there are people whose very economic existence relies on this system. They're in contracting business often. They are in diversity training. They are frequently affirmative action officers. Mr. Jackson, you know, what would happen tomorrow if we woke up and said race will no longer be a consideration? What would happen to some of these folks if we woke up and said, hey, there's no longer any discrimination. Race is no longer a consideration.
Yeah, but they would say, look, as long as there's discrimination, there needs to be somebody like me out there
who
has access.
It. Yeah, but there is not discrimination. The only racial discrimination that's taking place at these colleges and most other places is discrimination against whites.
Okay, now
these civil rights people have created an industry. It's their business, and they're not about to go out of business.
Okay, now I want you to go back to that the speech that you made. What did you say? And why was it so controversial?
So these students formed a group to support Hopwood and the abolition of racial preferences. And they asked me to be the faculty advisor. All student groups require a faculty advisor. And as you might expect, they didn't have a lot of choice. There are not many people willing to go public on this issue because it does result in quite a bit of harassment, intimidation. So I agreed to be their faculty advisor, and they held a press conference that they had arranged. And I spoke to the press explaining what was involved. And I said, I made two statements that are seen as controversial. The first was, I said that the reason you have racial preferences is because blacks and Mexican Americans are not academically competitive with whites and Asians. And that was seen as extremely controversial. And of course, all I try to point out, that's merely a statement of fact. Of course, that's why you have preferences. You give handicaps to poorer golfers to enable them to play the game with better golfers. And the only reason blacks and Mexican Americans are given preferences is that they would not get in the desired numbers without them. So that's not an opinion. I've been asked, what studies do you base that opinion? It's not an opinion, it's just a statement of the fact. Obviously, you have preferences because you're not competitive. Then one reporter asked me, do you attribute this, to what do you attribute this? And I said, to tell you the truth, I don't know. I'm not an authority on educational outcomes. But he persisted. He says, you think it's genetic, you think it's cultural. I said, I think it's cultural. Now another reporter hits me from the other side and says, are you saying some cultures are inferior to others? You see, there was no
and,
easy...
And what did you say about that?
What I said is it does appear that there are some groups, you know, whether or not they think we called cultures, I don't know. I'm using their term. But it clearly appears that there are some groups that take education a lot more seriously than other groups, that spend more time at it. It's study after study seems to show that Asians just spend more time doing homework. They are less likely to cut school. And it seems to me that that's a very plausible explanation for why the different groups have different educational outcomes.
Okay, so you said that. I mean, the newspaper in Austin picked it up. The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, everybody all over the country, maybe all over the world, I don't know, said...
No, indeed. I've gotten reports from South Africa, from London. It has been indeed picked up all over the world.
A worldwide deal. University of Texas professor Lino Graglia
says blacks and Mexican Americans are not academically competitive with whites.
Right.
That's the shocking headline. Well, that's just is the statement of why you have preferences. Of course that's the case.
Now, let me interject something here. A month before he said that, maybe 2 months before he said that, the University of California Board of Regents released a task force report on outreach prepared by 35 different people that were commissioned as a result of a resolution that I sponsored on July 20th of 1995 when we eliminated preferences. That task force said the average SAT of a black student coming from the highest income group, 60,000 and over, is lower than the average SAT of Asians and whites from the lowest income group, which is $20,000. The report went on to say that black students and Latino students, unfortunately, were not, quote, competitively admissible. The same thing that he said that he got in trouble for.
Your report.
We have a report that's saying the same thing. So it's people reacting to this on the basis of political correctness.
Okay.
He was right.
Okay. Now
I've been arguing in writing. I wrote against the affirmative action in a Pennsylvania law review in 1971, you know, 26 years ago. So I have written and said this for over 25 years now. Of course, your statements seem to attract more attention when they're at a press conference rather than in a law review or even in a journal of political opinion, in which I have written this sort of thing many times.
And when there's an election impending in Houston as well.
And when there's an election, and when people are on edge in Austin because they're so upset about the Hopwood decision, because the liberals have lost a big one. They were told that what they were doing all these years is unconstitutional. I've been telling them that. And my goodness, I turn out to be right, it seems. And they're unhappy with that because liberals are not supposed to lose. They never lose, and they lost this one, and so they're very
big
edgy.
So here we are with both you guys who have become very controversial in many ways. In the 10 minutes or so that we have left, I want to ask you, what should we do for the future? You passed Proposition 209. Tell us specifically what that does and then what you're trying to do in other states since that time.
Proposition 209 basically says that no government franchise in California can discriminate against anyone on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin. And it says a preference to one is, in effect, discrimination against another. It's as simple as that. Now, we still have a big mountain to climb in this nation on the basis of skin color. It's huge. We are not still in this nation at a point where we are a colorblind society. And I think it's going to be a while before we get there. But we're not going to get there by taking race into account and discriminating against people. And so what Proposition 209 is saying, all right, let's begin that heavy lifting that we as a nation are going to have to do, and let's begin it by treating everybody the same. In the final analysis, government jobs, which is really where affirmative action preferences are taking place, amounts to what, 5% of the jobs that are out there. The rest of this journey, we're going to have to go on the basis of our hearts and minds, getting rid of the stereotypes, stop believing that black people and Latinos are inferior, stop thinking that women can't manage departments, get rid of those biases, they're nonsense. And ironically, the places that are driving this debate most are the places that are becoming the most racially and ethnically diverse. It's no coincidence that Texas and California, which have 150 or more different races and ethnic backgrounds and cultures, are the places that are saying this doesn't make any sense. We don't know what boxes to check anymore. And so I think that we're now beginning that long process of truly becoming one nation that does not rely on these silly little boxes to define who gets what benefits.
The American Civil Rights Institute, you and some other folks have formed it. What are you trying to do?
We are trying to get the Congress to make this the law of the land. We're trying to get other states to also embrace this proposition. We're trying to get the American people to realize that discrimination against anybody is wrong. We're trying to get the American people to understand that we need to get rid of these stereotypes and to become one nation that does not look at these immutable traits of skin color and gender and ethnic background.
Ward, let me ask it this way, and let me grant you, even though I'm not necessarily agreeing with you, but let me grant you that there might be a segment of the population making their living at making things more difficult. I suspect that the vast majority of people, however, who agree that some preferences or some affirmative action should be helpful and all, really and truly believe that. What do you say to them? How do you get them to think about this issue in the way you'd like them to think about it? Or how do you get them to come around to your side, if you can?
Two things. This is a moral issue. This is one of those things that as a nation, if we're going to mean anything at all, we have to buy into the principle that we're not going to use these factors, these five factors in that Proposition 209, we're not going to use these factors. We won't even debate using these factors to discriminate against anybody. That is really what the founders meant when they said we hold these truths to be self-evident, and they talked about unalienable rights. That's what they meant. And if we as a nation are going to come together, we have to agree on that fundamental premise. And so what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do, is to get the nation to understand that this is about an ideal. And if you don't live up to your ideals, then you may as well throw them out. And I don't think that too many people really believe that we should be discriminating against people on the basis of those traits.
Lino, there are two things about the Supreme Court I want to ask. First, on the Hopwood case, and my understanding is the Supreme Court decided not to review it, so effectively they left the Fifth Circuit's ruling as it was. Is
That's
that basically
correct.
True?
Yes.
All right, so secondly, there is a case, however, the Piscataway case. Tell us briefly what that is, where it is sort of in the Supreme Court system, and what the implications are likely to be depending upon how they come down on that issue.
Well, that case has been filed. I believe I don't know whether it's been argued, but it will be decided in the current Supreme Court term, that is, before next June. It's a peculiar case. It's not your typical situation. There you had two women, one black, one white, and it was a reduction in force, and they decided they were supposedly of equal seniority, and they discharged or laid off the white rather than the black just so that they could maintain one black person in this particular little sub-department. So it's open racial discrimination. One person is discharged because she's white, who wouldn't have been discharged except she's white. And that's what's gone to the Supreme Court. What the Supreme Court is going to do with that case, it would be extremely risky to predict at any time what lawyers are going to do. The court could well, I would expect that the court will not allow that racial discrimination, but it may do it. It's such a peculiar circumstances that it may be a ruling that is not of general application. On the other hand, if they decide to issue a broad ruling, they could work real damage against all racial preferences.
Okay. Now, the last question I really have for both of you, and Ward, let me start with you. People have a tendency to ask about, to question, to at least think about, what drives somebody to get out front on an issue like this, an issue that in which you're going to make a lot of friends, you talk to a lot of people, audiences, you were on C-SPAN today, actually, which I saw you on, and people stand up and they clap and they applaud and they say, Ward Connerly is terrific. And then on the other side, you've got a lot of people who say, Ward Connerly is a racist. You've even been called a racist. What drives you to do something like this?
I love my country. I love my country. I believe in its ideals. I'm a product of those ideals, that melting pot. Come from a very varied varied ethnic background. I believe in the system. The system will work. We don't like change. We didn't like change in the 60s. The segregationist said, no, absolutely not. Western civilization will end if we embrace integration. But I'm confident that black Americans, Latinos, can compete like everybody else. We've got the talent. We've got the ability. We just need the confidence. And we need to make sure that people aren't discriminating against us. But at its core, I believe in the ideals of this nation. I love my nation. I believe that fundamentally, we're good people. We're good people. You can trust us to do the right thing. And I look all around me and I see evidence of that every day. Colin Powell, Oprah Winfrey, Bill Cosby, Michael Jordan, four of the most influential people in America. You ask about the system and whether it works. You better believe it works. And unless we believe that, unless we believe in the system, our ideals, and believe that it can work for you, then we may as well abandon the system.
Okay. Lino, before I ask you to answer that question, one of the key issues I had really overlooked to this point, if you'll give me just a brief moment or so on it, is how this whole system, I think, was basically to work against people who had historically been disadvantaged through the slavery issue as an example. But somehow this whole affirmative action got into particularly women, to some extent Latinos, neither of which had ever been under slavery at all. Tell us about that first and then answer my original
slavery
question.
Slavery is the kind of argument that the proponents use it when it's there and ignore it when it's not. As I say, you've got to understand, again, that these racial preferences have nothing to do with past disadvantage. Someone applies to the Texas law school who's black. He's the son of two professors, and his family is very wealthy. He's admitted, he's given preference in admission because he's black. It has nothing to do with disadvantage. So that's a red herring. The whole thing is phony. That's all I can tell you about if you are looking to help people, the so-called underclass, the social pathologies of the single-family home, the welfare mothers, are indeed very sad situations which need our help in every way we can. What I'm saying is, these racial preferences in education and contracting are not designed to help those people. They will provide help for people who need it the least, while in fact disadvantaging people who are actually in a better position to ask for our help than many of them are.
All right, and as far as you personally, I mean, you're a tenured college professor making tons of money, probably in the classroom, maybe once or twice a week, whether you need to be or not. I know who you are.
Well, why? A few overstatements there. a single ton maybe. And right. I have to be in the classroom 5 or 6 times a week.
All right. Other than, I don't know if you're doing it for an ego trip or what, I mean, why would you come out and talk about these things? And
because I'm a professor of constitutional law, supposed to study and write and help people understand constitutional issues. And some 30 years ago, I saw when the court was ordering busing for school racial balance that, first of all, it was behaving very improperly. This was not what the Constitution required. It was not what the 64 Act required, and it was going to have very bad consequences. They weren't going to achieve more school integration. They were going to achieve less, which is exactly what happened. As the whites have left our major cities, the major cities are now overwhelmingly non-white school systems. I wrote about that, and I think a lot of people have come to think, and I, of course, put up with a lot of heat for that, but I think a lot of people have come to think over the last 20, 25 years that I may have been right about that. And I feel the same is exactly true on this issue, that if we're going to have a multiracial society, of which there are not many examples in the world or in history of successful races living together, if we're going to have one, the only way we're going to have that is if government de-emphasizes the importance of race. If government teaches us we're all the same, we're all just people, not that blacks are really very different, are entitled to different rules, and there's the black exemption. They don't have to meet the requirements of whites as to getting into schools or other things. And to have the idea that there should be black exemptions generally, and to teach people that their problems are not the result of their own shortcomings, but because others hate them, is incorrect factually, and it's the worst message that can be given.
Poisonous.
Ward,
poisonous.
In just a few seconds that we have left, you're writing a book, Toward One Nation, I think, which will be hopefully out next year. What could that person do who wanted to get involved with you? What could they call your group or what?
They can call the American Civil Rights Institute in Sacramento, California at 916-444-2278. And we would direct them appropriately on how they can get involved.
The other side of your issue, who is the biggest group that's in the opposition to you? Would it be the NAACP or Jesse Jackson's group or who?
Well, I think that Jesse Jackson, frankly, is becoming a broken record. I don't think that many people are listening anymore. The group that seems to be gaining the most traction is the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund.
Okay, MALDEF, M-A-L-D-E-F. If you'll call us, we probably can put you in touch with them. I really appreciate both of you being here. And whether you agree or disagree with the positions you've heard discussed, we sincerely hope that you're now more informed and that you'll make your voice heard on the issue in your state, regardless of your position on it. We've been talking about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.